The Sewers of Paris is independent, ad-free, and listener-supported. Head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to join the folks who make the show possible and to check out the rewards for backers. Hello and welcome to The Sewers of Paris. My guest this week is illustrator and film-obsessive Dashiell Silva, who you might know from his excellent Oscar guides and also as an artist on the just-announced Netflix series Dead India, which looks, by the way, amazing. Dashiell grew up in the west of Ireland, where nobody understood his taste in film. That was, in hindsight, extremely queer. His devotion to Sunset Boulevard and Mommy Dearest made him feel like some kind of weird anomaly in his little town, until he started creating art and discovering what his talents were truly capable of. We'll have that conversation in a minute. First, a reminder that The Sewers of Paris is on Twitter and Facebook. I post clips of the stuff that we talk about on each episode, and I am particularly excited about posting clips from this one. And I hope you'll join me for our next fun-friendly live stream on July 4th at 11 a.m. Pacific. It's a nice, relaxing time to just hang out and chat. There's a link at the top of The Sewers of Paris Twitter feed. And check out my YouTube channel for my latest Culture Cruise video, where I do a deep dive on LGBTQ milestones from TV and film. This week's video is all about the documentary Paris is Burning, its hidden history going back to the 1800s, and how Madonna lifted more than just voguing from queer culture. You can find it at youtube.com/mattbaum, or just search YouTube for Culture Cruise. Now, here's Dashiell. Well, this week I'm speaking with Dashiell, an artist based in the UK. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here. It's exciting.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
The film version of Ghost World.
For folks who were not around in the 90s to enjoy that, I guess, maybe, was it like post-90s? Was it like early 2000s?
Oh, it was 2001.
How do you describe that movie to people?
It's a really good look at that really awkward period just when, say, high school or secondary school is ending and, like, you know, the grown-up world, whether that's employment or college or whatever, is about to start, and you're beginning to move past, like, people in your life who'd been assigned to you originally, like classmates, and, you know, you're beginning to choose the people in your life a lot more. And but I think that, like, what struck with me in it is that, like, with a lot of coming-of-age things, they feel like coming-of-age stories. Ghost World doesn't feel like a coming-of-age story.
So what was it about the movie that drew you in?
I think because it felt like I had discovered it, because, like, you know, you hear about certain teen movies like Breakfast Club or Pretty in Pink or all the ones which are, you know, like written down as, like, the teen movies. This one, I just remember seeing it. I just remember seeing the TV ads for it when I was, like, a kid, and just thinking, oh, there's something really weird about this. I like it. And then we finally rent on DVD, and I just was, I don't know why it was, I was just really obsessed by it. I think because everything in it seems pretty pointless. It reminds me a lot of where I grew up. Mm-hmm. The fact that Enid, the main character played by Thora Birch, is like an artist who just, you know, draws in a sketchbook and draws cartoons, and that it doesn't have to be this, art doesn't have to be like this huge piece, really inspired me when I was a teen, and it made me want to draw, and it made me eventually enroll in my secondary school's art class, and then eventually go to art school, and eventually do what I do now, working professionally in the arts. Like, it inspired me in a way that I probably wouldn't have had normally, because everything in my upbringing was, like, very, 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 you get a useful job and you do a useful course in college and you end up having kids and all of that, which, of course, is not the case for me.
Had you previously not thought of yourself as an artist? Like, after seeing that art, that movie, was that the first time you thought that that was something you could be?
Yeah, literally. I was told, I think I wanted to do art when I started secondary school at age 12, but my parents said, no, you should do home economics or something. And I decided I'll do home economics. And I kind of thought, oh, I'm never going to be good enough to do that. Like, I've got no ideas. I'm not creative. I'd, like, done bits of drawing when I was a kid, but nothing substantial. And it was seeing that that just made me think, oh, people can make things. It was a lot of just, like, I don't know why, I saw a lot of how pointless the world was, and then I saw a lot of it based on the world I was growing up in, which felt valid to me.
Do you mean, like, it felt pointless, like, the trajectory that you were on, like, the assumptions that were being put on you felt pointless?
I think, okay, I need to sort of explain one thing about, like, the experience of growing up where I grew up. Is that okay?
Yeah, sure.
Cool. So I grew up in the west of Ireland, and the weird thing about growing up there is that it's difficult for, usually for Americans and also for British people to understand this, but Irish TV is generally unwatchably awful. It's all game shows and chat shows, and you rarely see your world being broadcast back to you, like things that are recognizable to you. So a lot of the cultural touchstones that you end up having are American or British. And it, because certain things in American culture and the way it's depicted are so like codified, like the way the high school world is depicted in like high school movies, and high school isn't like that in other countries, it can make your own experience of your own life feel less valid, which is really weird and messed up. But what I liked about Ghost World was that it sort of felt somewhat, these girls didn't feel like they had like aspirations. I didn't feel like I was worked, that they were like, there was going to be an end goal for them, which seemed similar to the world I was living in.
So what was the world that you were living in like? Like, how is it different from American teenager depictions?
So I am Irish, but I've lived in the UK like most of my adult life, and I'm a British citizen now as well. And like, Irish people aren't really supposed to do that. And I think I just never quite latched on to the society there for a bunch of reasons. I try not to be too cruel about the place because people live there. I don't. But it's like things like not things like not really having like a roadmap, which is what you get in films to like to help pave a way for you and just to give you like a blueprint. The fact that I didn't really have that really threw me for a loop. And I don't feel like I answered the question, did I?
Well, you know, I think we're kind of getting to how you just felt kind of feels like disconnected from where you're growing up. Like, you knew that it didn't really work for you, but you didn't know what the alternative was.
Yeah, that's exactly it. There's this thing like, it's a thing in like Irish society. This is where I'm probably going to sound mean, but to me, it often feels very provincial in a way that it's fine if that works for you. It didn't work for me. And if it doesn't work for you, then you can end up being made to feel like a freak, basically. So it's kind of one of the things I struggled with there. And I think it's kind of what I liked about Ghost World so much, that there are these norms which are presented to the girls in the movie, which are kind of nonsense, and they're not even rebelling against them, but they're just sort of like quietly clapping back about it, which is how I felt about these things. Like, I wasn't trying to act like some sort of revolutionary or anything. A lot of the aspirations didn't feel like they made sense to me. And just the sort of like, the idea of like liking things and not wanting to know a lot about something that's a little bit esoteric, like that really, really resonated with me, because I felt that like, oh, I really love old movies, like, but that wasn't really encouraged so much where I was living at the time.
So what changed after you saw Ghost World? I know you started thinking of yourself more as an artist and started doing more arts, but how did that like manifest in your life?
Embarrassingly, I just copied what Enid does in the movie. I just like had a little sketchbook and I would just draw really dumb cartoons in it. Unfortunately, nothing very like good in any way now that I think about it. But it was just nice to feel that like I was like observing things and paying attention to things and feeling like I was keeping some sort of record or like some sort of commentary, even if no one was listening to me. That felt like a nice habit to sort of start developing. Unfortunately, I've never really kept up with keeping a sketchbook since, but it's, I think on the most recent rewatch I did this week, like the Scarlett Johansson character in it, who is Enid's best friend, like she, at the start of the movie, there's like this divergence between the two of them. They were really close friends in school, and it's meant to be all about them growing apart. So Scarlett wants to move into her own place. She wants to have a job. She basically wants to, you know, be a grown up. And Enid sort of sees that like a selling out in some way, even though it's just basic growing up. And like watching this time, I kind of felt myself sympathizing more with the Scarlet character, maybe because I'm now much older than either of those characters are at the time. But at the time as a teen, there was something about just Enid's, because it's not quite rebelling, but just the way that her unease at like at supposed obvious social norms resonated with me.
So tell me about the art that you made. Like, you know, copying is honestly, like, a lot of people that I talk to, it's how they get started. They see something that they like, they know that they like it, they don't know how to make something exactly, so they start to learn. When did you start noticing that you were making something that felt more yours?
I think actually it wouldn't have been until many years after I finished my undergraduate degree, if I'm honest. This will probably get like a little bit real, but so my teen years were pretty awful. I had quite an abusive mother, and it sort of like propelled me to like not want to go back to where I lived ever and sort of distance myself from that place. And it's strange because part of the, at the same time as I was latching on to this point of view that was given to me by something like Ghost World, a lot of things that had previously been my identity, like being a good student, all of that suddenly started to crumble. Like my grades at school just tanked. And I was really just quite angry at everything and sort of phoning in a lot of things, just openly cheating on tests and copying people's homework. Because everything was just like a means to let, so I could get to draw more. Like when I was at home, because I used to have to stay at school from 9 a.m. till 9 p.m. when the 2 hours I'd be at home from like 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. I was just constantly teaching myself Photoshop and just drawing and drawing, drawing, doing as much as I could to try and like just see how good I could be. I was like on websites like Side7, which is like a proto DeviantArt, just looking at things as much as I could. And I kind of never thought that this could be something. I sort of thought this is a bit of a delusion, but it was nice to like have something just to cling on to, because it was a very, very dark time, and it was very like felt like I was very alone, and I kind of needed that outlet.
Sure. It sounds like it was a real escape for you. Like were you drawing things that were, I don't know, like wish fulfillment, or, you know, like, did you have fantasies that you were bringing to life on the page?
No. It was a lot more like, if anything, it'd be like, say, reportage. Like I remember my dad and I and my brother were like going on a trip across the country to see our cousins. And like, there was a nail got stuck in the tire of his car. And like, I just drew that like in the way that you would take like a snapshot. I was just sort of like documenting that. And you know, that's a nothing event, in there's not even a story to it, but I'm remembering it now, God, many, many years later. So I don't know if that like necessarily means anything, but I remember that weekend was literally the weekend that I'd started going, yes, I'm going to start drawing. I'm going to be that person. And I wonder if like I would have remembered that had I not started like drawing those things, like those weird little details then, because I'd done other things in the meantime, but it was always these small like sketchy bits. It was rarely like a piece of work.
So it sounds like it's interesting that you were drawing like kind of memoir stuff when it sounds like it was kind of a rough time to be growing up, and might not have been the kind of thing that you would want to remember. Like, was that a way of focusing on the good stuff that you did want to keep close?
Possibly. I think that it was mostly just like a hobby, because we weren't really encouraged to do much in the way of hobbies. we lived in like a kind of like a, I guess you'd call it a suburb, but it was like a little village that's like 5 miles away from like the nearest town, which is in the middle of nowhere. The town is like, it was, I'm trying to think of a US equivalent, but it would be a bit like we lived in North Dakota.
Sure,
But
so a bit isolated.
yeah, very isolated in every way, like far away, little to no cultural output or weight. And it's easy just to feel like you're Luke Skywalker at the start of Star Wars, just like, why am I here? What's the point of anything? I don't live in this fabulous city.
So I know that you mentioned that classic movies were a big part of, or like a passion for you. And today the Oscars are like a big deal for you. How much were like movies a part of your life then?
I actually had like they were a huge part because there's a magazine. Do you know a magazine called Empire
Yeah, I think I know
magazine?
the name. I think I just always assumed it was a magazine about New York, but I have no idea what it actually is.
Oh, it's it's a UK only magazine, I think, but I think they do like I think they're like one of the main UK film magazines. They're not like highbrow like Sight and Sound is, which is like the BFI's one. They're like but they're not like a fan magazine. Anyway, I used to read that a lot as a kid, because it just helped give me like some sort of framework. Like that's how I work best. Usually, if I get like if you give me a broad history of something like film or something, and I'll read through it and I'll be like, okay, so this is the range of the history and all that, and I can get an idea of what's out there. And like for like my brother and me and my dad, like we use this to my dad and I especially use it to build our relationship, because our mother wouldn't let us see our dad for like a long period of time, and he would like tell us about just films he'd seen and like going, oh my god, Double Indemnity, you mean you've seen it? And like one day he showed me what is now my favorite film and still is, Sunset Boulevard, which is amazing.
How old were you when you saw Sunset Boulevard?
I think I was 16. It was on TV, and like, just I just was enraptured the whole time watching it. Just everything, and like, there's just so much in it. Like, it's funny and it's dark and it's desperate and it's pathetic and it's also really camp and queer, but it's also like really serious and real, and it's got lots of talking about film. It's got fabulous dialogue and everyone just being fabulous and making lots of witty references. And kind of because of that, I started looking up like a lot of very basic, classic film books. So like I got lucky and I watched some of the films which have really stuck with me, which also on reflection, and I didn't plan this, are also really, really queer. So like there's Sunset Boulevard, Mildred Pierce, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, All About Eve. Like I managed to find a way somehow of watching all of them, because my mother wasn't exactly very approving of my brother and me watching anything, it seems, because for instance one time she walked in on us watching Psycho, and I would have been 16, my brother would have been 14, and Psycho is shocking, but it's not exactly a snuff film,
Yeah, there's, I think, is there one? There's that one very like startling death in kind of the middle of it, and I think another towards the end, and I think that's kind of it. Mostly it's just kind of a psychological drama.
Like this, and it's that thing where like the shower murder is so it's been parodied so much that everyone knows it. Like it's in every
Yeah.
single
It's a bit like Austin Powers, where you see it and you're like, oh, it was very new when it happened, but now it feels so like hacky, even though it really invented a genre.
Oh, completely. Although also Austin Powers destroyed James Bond.
Oh, I don't, I think James Bond can, I think he's resilient.
No. The reason they stopped making them after Die Another Day, that really terrible one with Halle Berry, is because they did say like Austin Powers ruined it.
Is
Like
that
they
right?
can't. Yeah, they because they couldn't make it. Austin Powers like rather wittily punctures like a lot of the James Bond-isms. That's kind of why Die Another Day is really silly, and it ends up seeming more like an Austin Powers movie, because like it's why they really it's why they really, when they rebooted it with Daniel Craig, they're like, okay, we're going to try and make this serious and as much of a real film as we can.
Huh. Oh, I didn't know that. Which is the one that has John Cleese in it, though?
He's introduced in The World Is Not Enough.
Hmm. It's interesting that they're like, oh no, Austin Powers ruined it by making it funny, but like also they had cast John Cleese in it like just a few years earlier.
I know, right?
Anyway, so yes. So Sunset Boulevard and Psycho and all these like old movies starring like great like female stars of many decades prior, like it must have been difficult to find other people who could appreciate that. I know you said like your dad was very into movies, but I don't know. I'm just picturing like a 16-year-old boy in a small town appreciating Mildred Pierce, and it seems like that must have been a bit solitary.
Oh, it absolutely was. Like I did try with like my friends. I remember, oh boy, I remember one time we had like a film marathon where I made far too many of my secondary school friends. Like, I mean about six people who were all pretty straight, you know, like pretty straight laced.
Yeah.
I think a few of them were quite Christian too. One of them definitely was. I made them watch in an unending sequence Mildred Pierce, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, and All About Eve, because I was like, so this is Joan Crawford and this is Bette Davis and they're both amazing and they're amazing for these reasons, and now we're going to watch the movie that, oh, and they hated each other, so now we're going to watch the movie that they made together. And I don't know if you've ever done those movies in quick succession, but some are better than others. Baby Jane is great, but it's a real slog at times.
Yeah, I had a similar experience with John Waters, where I made some of my heterosexual friends in high school watch a bunch of John Waters films, and they were like, I can't believe they're like, they were scandalized. That was not the, in hindsight, it's very enjoyable that I was able to do that to them, but I wanted a more of an appreciation from them at the time.
I mean, I love that you said John Waters, because my housemates and I in college did the same thing. We would watch a John Waters movie every Christmas. And like most of them are better the second time round whenever you're prepared for the pacing, right?
Yeah.
So like we watched Pink Flamingos 1 year, and then next year we decided on Female Trouble, which is good, but there's a good 40 plus minutes in the middle where not a whole lot happens. And we were like, cool, is this gonna keep going? Then all of a sudden, Divine gets acid thrown in her face, and we're like, holy shit, that happened? And then we're back in watching it all of a sudden. It was nuts.
Yeah, nice holiday tradition.
Yeah. I mean, look, I fully count The Lion in Winter as a Christmas movie, as a legit, I mean, it is when it's set at Christmas, but it's about vicious family acrimony and plotting and fighting. Is there anything more Christmas than that?
So you mentioned that you started to think of yourself more as an artist after college, and it sounds like in college you did find like a group of people who had more of an appreciation for the things that you appreciated.
Yeah.
Where did you go, and what were you looking for?
So, okay, I gotta do like a quick social studies thing here. So, the time I was like growing up in Ireland, it was a period called the Celtic Tiger. Have you ever heard of that?
No.
Cool. So during the 90s and noughties, there was like this period of unprecedented economic growth, and it was largely everything being bought on credit. So obviously that came to an end in like 2007. But it meant that from my parents' generation, suddenly there was a generation of people that went from being kind of working class to being very middle class in within their lifetimes, and sending their children to like, you know, fancy schools and stuff. But it meant that what was strange is you had people who were, say, had become financially middle class, but they didn't share a lot of the things that happens with some middle class people, like they like the arts or whatever. Like if you go to college, it's to get a useful degree. This very like mechanistic view of education was still kind of hanging around. This was kind of like the climate I was going to secondary school in. It was all like, you know, you've got to do well on your leaving cert to get really high points, to get into a really good course, to end up being a lawyer or a doctor. Like, you're either a lawyer or a doctor. Anything else is pointless. Which, of course, is a horrible way to raise your children. But because my home life was so chaotic, like, and on reflection years later, I was very badly depressed as a kid. Like, I'd go days in school without talking to anyone just because I could. And as an adult, I'm like, that is not okay. And the fact that, you know, I didn't know how to reach out to anyone or that no one saw that, that's a bit of an indictment to me of the society. But I remember one day I had my homework diary, and at the back of it has a list of all of the courses that were being that were at colleges in Ireland at the time. And I mean, much like Enid and Rebecca in Ghost World, I couldn't even think past the end of the week, much less 2 years down the line to what college course I was going to be doing. Like, I know everyone has a similar experience that no one knows what they're doing, but for me, it was literally like I had no idea at all. So I remember at the back of it, there was just this list of all the courses, and there was one place that had a thing called Institute of Art and Design Dunleary, and they had animation. And I was like, oh, animation, you can study that, and you can study that in this country? So I basically nagged my dad to go to an open day. When it came to filling out my form for like my college choices, I only put one choice, and it was that animation course, which luckily I got. Another way I was lucky in that college course, you had to do a portfolio to get in, and I did pretty well in that portfolio. So it meant when it came time to do my final exams, I just had to like scooch by, which was really good given the precarious mental state I was in.
So where was the college?
The college was in a place called Dunleary, which is a suburb of Dublin, which is where most of the colleges are. And they were like the National Film School, and I had a reasonably okay time there. I met like a lot of friends that were really important to me at that time. I met a few like tutors that were to this day are really, really, really helpful and wonderful friends to me. Unfortunately, when I was there, I fell into a habit of like trying to be too good a student and like be, you know, just doing everything I could to be a good student, even though I wasn't being like a good artist. So like trying to get grades and do as much work as possible and all of that kind of stuff. And it led to me having like quite a severe mental breakdown when I was in third year. And then after that, I kind of was just like, oh, screw it, I'm done. I'm just going to wait out this course for the next year, which probably wasn't the best thing, but it's what happened.
So it does sound like it was a pretty exhausting experience for you. What was keeping you going?
I honestly don't know. I think it was just the thought that I felt like I couldn't go home. Because I didn't want to at all. At this point, I still had a relationship with my mother, but I didn't want to spend time with her. So I sort of felt like, well, I've got nowhere else to go. I better just make the best of it. And it wasn't all a struggle. Like there were things that were wonderful. Like one thing I was excited about was the fact that part of my course involved film history classes. So suddenly, I'm like this country bumpkin that's going from, you know, trying desperately to catch Mildred Pierce on TCM, like on a Thursday night or something when it's airing one time every 3 months, to suddenly I'm having lectures where we watch Battleship Potemkin and The Red Shoes. And it was like, oh my God, but I've read about these films. I've waited so long. So those were parts that were genuinely wonderful. The amount of work involved in just like meeting my coursework, that was very difficult, like having to work from 9 a.m. to 11 p.m. basically every day for like months on end. And that was probably a choice that like in retrospect I shouldn't have done. But, you know, one always sees these things with like 20/20 hindsight.
What were the things you mentioned? Battleship Potemkin and some other, like, I guess some of those sound like movies that you really only know and appreciate if you are a film student. Like,
sorry.
Yeah, I mean, as a former film student myself, I think the only times that movie has come up in conversation has been with other people in my program. But there's sort of a magic to, like, I guess, really digging down to the foundations of how cinema was built, like how movies were created at, like, you know, mm-hmm. because they've only been around for like 100 or ish years. So when a new art form started to, or new technology started to exist, how did people turn that into an art? And it sounds like for you, like, there's these new possibilities that are unfolding, and this new technology that is, and technology, I mean techniques that are available to you. So you're sort of, I guess your ontogeny is recapitulating the phylogeny of cinema. Maybe the most pretentious sentence I've ever said.
Love it. Yeah, like, it to me was also just like wonderful validation. Like, I complained about like the provincialism where I grew up and stuff, and it's difficult to say that without sounding like a snob or an elitist, because it's just how different people talk about different things, right? But because I didn't have much of a connection to where I was growing up, and sort of maybe willfully chose that a bit, it just meant that, like, I would just feel like, oh God, you're just talking about these things, about these places, and I don't care. It all seems so pointless, and, you know, no one cares about my fabulously witty remarks. These are the thoughts of a teenager, mind you. But what I just loved, like, especially when it came to like classic cinema, it's like, oh, there's this breadth of like wonderful texts that like people have like talked about and known about and made so many wonderful remarks about and like, you know about. Like, I feel like I understand The Simpsons and you know, Woody Allen movies now, even though, like, because I used to watch a few Woody Allen movies as a teen and liked them a bit too much.
You know, it's a good point. Like, you really can't appreciate The Simpsons until you appreciate, like, the weird, obscure references that they're making.
Oh, yeah. There's a joke which, to this day, like, really, which I heard it and I'm like, this is exactly my sense of humor. So I love Tennessee Williams so much. I don't know why, because I'm not, like, it. I think because it seems really exotic to me, the South. exactly, and the South and madness and, like, dominating mother figures, oh boy. But there's a great line in, do you know the episode where, with the Itchy and Scratchy movie?
Yeah.
So when Bart's not allowed to go see it, and it's kind of driving him insane, but everyone else is allowed to go see it, like, Lisa's allowed to go see it, even Maggie, I think, is allowed to go see it. And Lisa says to Homer, Dad, Bart's developing the manic fervor of a Tennessee Williams heroine.
yeah.
And it's like, as soon as she said that, I'm like, oh my God, that works in so many. And it's, Frasier does this too, where there's an art to writing like a really good reference joke, right? Where if you get the reference, that's great. If you don't, you can still get a joke out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, you just have to hear demented fervor and you're like, ha ha.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, and the Streetcar Named Desire episode with the musical is also really good, because again, that works on so many levels.
I don't think we had a VCR at the time, but I had a cassette recorder, so I recorded the audio of the episode onto a cassette tape, and would just listen to that episode over and over. It's this weird, whatever I was, like, 9-year-old kid memorizing and reciting an episode of The Simpsons about A Streetcar Named Desire.
And it's just so good. Even, like, the things, like, you know, cool, she can fly.
Yes.
I think it's supposed to represent her descent into madness.
Yeah. There's so many, like, now that I'm thinking back to that, it's such a rich episode. There's, like, a reference to Hitchcock at one point. There's a reference to
Ayn Rand.
The Great Escape. Oh, my God, yeah, you're right. The Ayn Rand childcare, daycare
school
facility.
School for Yeah.
yes, with a giant sign on the wall that says A is A.
Yeah. Like, gosh. And so many of these things, it's like, I know this is a reference, but it's also like, yeah, the Hitchcock thing, like, this makes no sense. Why is this here? Or this isn't a Hitchcock episode.
Right. So that sends you down the rabbit hole. And then, you know, like, it's this obscure thing, like, I guess not obscure, but the sound of the pacifiers being sucked is so similar to the sound of the birds in The Birds.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, I understand that, but We've been in a Streetcar Named Desire episode. Why is this suddenly a Hitchcock moment?
Right.
Very strange. Like, I often say as well, like, I mean, obviously so many great women have portrayed Blanche DuBois, you know, Jessica Tandy, Jessica Lange, Gillian Anderson, you know, Vivian Leigh. Like, they, you know, it's one of the great roles for actresses. But I'm convinced that Marge Simpson is the best Blanche DuBois opposite the worst Stanley Kowalski.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, you see her pathos off screen.
Exactly.
Off stage. And so, Yeah, that moment where Homer's yelling at her from outside about his being unable to open his pudding cup.
Yeah.
It's just such a thing of beauty.
And it's like, and like, it's why the episode's so great, right? Because it's all these like wonderful, just like barbed comments about community theater. Like,
yeah.
Like, you know, again, of course there'll be an over ambitious director that's doing like a musical version of A Streetcar Named Desire. Like, it's just like the start of Death Becomes Her, you know, with the musical based on Sweet Bird of Youth.
Right. Yes. Yes.
And you have people walking out going, oh my God, who would ever make a, how distasteful, why would anyone make a musical of Sweet Bird of Youth? Yes. And like, I mean, that was, so as much as like certain films like meant a lot to me growing up that were also hugely queer, there's a few films which I definitely remember seeing ads for and like wanting to watch more than anything. And Death Becomes Her was one of them. For some reason it was shown a lot on one of the stations, and I just never got around to seeing it. And then I saw it when I was like, I think like 18. I was like going, this film is perfection. Oh, it's so good.
It is a real treat. I only saw it, I think, I must have been like in my early 30s when I first saw it. Just somehow passed me by. Despite, I used to work next to the castle from that movie. A time when I was working at Industrial Light and Magic, and yeah, in the lobby of the building that I was in was this castle, miniature castle model. And I was like, oh, I wonder what that is, for like,
oh my God,
for months, until I like finally was able to identify it as like the castle that like Bruce Willis is dangling off of at the end.
Oh, I mean, it's so good. It's, I mean, it's a Robert Zemeckis film, so it's very well crafted, like the you know, but it's one of those things where I point to films like that and Practical Magic and what's another good one? First Wives Club, as like the fact that the common narrative is that these are bad films proves like a problem with the fact that most critics are straight middle-aged men.
Cause, like, yeah, yeah.
Because like all those films are objectively fabulous.
Right. Yeah, I think what you're seeing there is not so much that they're bad films, but that there are bad critics who are unaware of their prejudices. I just like literally yesterday watched the Disney John Carter of Mars and was talking afterwards about how it really is the story, it's the women's story, but the movie can't stand to spend any time with the women who are, yeah, you know, orders of magnitude more interesting than the male characters. But, you know, it was whatever, 2011, I think. And, you know, there was a sense that, well, you can't have an action film that stars women. That would be absurd. And so instead we get this mediocre magic boy movie, which we've seen a million times.
Yeah, I mean, I joke about this constantly, but I'm also deathly serious. Like, men just don't have the range. Like, yeah, at all. Whereas, like I point to as a way of proving this, just two case studies. So Sigourney Weaver has three Oscar nominations. Look, I'm getting into my Oscar stuff. Sigourney Weaver has three Oscar nominations, okay? And she received all three of them between 1986 and 1988. And they were for, 86 was for Aliens, a Best Actress one, another Best Actress one in 88 for Gorillas in the Mist, and then a Best Supporting Actress one in 88 for Working Girl. Three wildly different films, wildly different genres, characters, and just, of course, Sigourney can do it. Whereas people go on and on and on about Daniel Day-Lewis or Leonardo DiCaprio, and like, they could never do a rom-com. Like a straight rom-com.
It's true. It's extremely painfully and completely true. Like the frustration that I feel, like, in addition to just having watched John Carter of Mars, I also just watched both Wonder Woman and Captain Marvel, and I'm like, oh, these are movies. Anyway,
yes.
So yeah, you made it through college.
Yes, indeed. So there's this thing about Irish people, we're kind of expected to emigrate because the country has its issues, and that's a natural part of the experience, and especially you're meant to emigrate in like 2010 when the economy has disappeared.
Right, right.
Because Ireland was especially devastated by it, because they had gone from being a very poor country to being what they thought of was a rich country almost overnight. So suddenly construction, for instance, was 50% of the economy, which is never a good sign. So whenever the bubble burst, all that stopped and it was just, you know, devastation. There's these things called ghost estates, which are like housing developments, you know, like those like McMansion-y suburb things. And every single town in Ireland has one of them. There's one, like, I think it's since been completed, but it was left semi-derelict for about 7 years. There's one, like, not 200 meters from my dad's house. And, like, I remember when I first moved to the UK, which was right after I graduated, literally the day of my graduation, actually, now that I think about it. I remember one of the first things I saw when I moved here was the, I think it was the Sunday Times, doesn't really matter. Their magazine section, like, ran like this photo essay about the ghost estates of Ireland. And I remember being horrified beyond words because everyone knows these places when you live there. They're pretty common. And maybe people laugh them off a bit more than they should. But seeing it presented in this magazine, it was presented with the same visual language as they show you photos of Chernobyl.
Sure.
It's just like, you know, the Iron Curtain's fallen and it's just, you know, the people have been living with cold water flats, that kind of thing. And it's just like, oh my God, this is bad, especially when your country is really trying to put forward this narrative of it being a modern, dynamic, sexy Western European nation.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I guess that kind of colors your, I guess, perception of who you are and where you're from when you see how other people view this, like, exotic othering that they're, you know, feels like they're entitled to do.
It's also especially fraught for, like, from an Anglo-Irish perspective too. Like, it's a lot. I'm not going to go into it because it's one of those things where, like, I've had to do this a lot ever since the Brexit vote, like explaining Northern Ireland to either British or American people. And it's sort of like, oh, there's many, many hundreds of thousands of very complex rules and things. And you don't have to understand it, but you sort of get it after a while.
Mm-hmm. So what brought you, like, you were living, I think you said it was in a, like, a suburb of Dublin. And so what brought you to, did you go, like, straight to London? Because I think that's where you are now, right?
Yeah. I just went straight there. So it literally goes back to, like, when I was a kid. Like, I always remember being so depressed at, like, not living in a city. Like, I used to be obsessed with the Marvel Spider-Man cartoon when I was a kid. It's like, ooh, New York. And then I was obsessed with Friends because, ooh, New York. And then I was obsessed with Sex and the City because, ooh, New York. It was just the idea of, like, a city was really exciting to me. And I sort of thought, well, I can't afford to go to the US, so I'll go to the next nearest largest city, which was London. And I moved in the way that you're not supposed to move. I literally just packed a suitcase and got on a ferry and had nothing lined up, not a job, not a place to live. And I ended up, like, living in a hostel for, like, 2 months with a lot of fun-loving Australians, which was, to this day, if I hear loud Australian accents, I get flashbacks a bit.
Australians do love fun, don't they?
It sounds like I'm not being okay here. It's specifically the fun-loving part, you know, when you're in a hostel, sometimes you're just a bit like, I know you're having fun, but I'm not here on a booze holiday. I'm trying to live.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
What was your plan, like, going to London? Like, you wanted to see and be in a big city. Did you know what you wanted to be aside from a city dweller?
Oh, I hadn't a clue. Like, I knew I wanted to do something broadly, like, in media or the arts or something. I figured I would end up working in animation just because that's what my degree was in. But if that didn't happen, I would also be kind of okay. Because I kind of thought, I sort of toyed the idea of, oh, I could be, like, an illustrator. That could be fun. That seems like the kind of thing that I'd like. But I was totally ill-equipped to, like, pursue that in any real way, like, technically, emotionally, financially. Like, it wouldn't have happened at that point, but I sort of just, I was more concerned in just like, cool, I have to just get settled because I can't go back to, God, I can't go back to my parents. Right. That was sort of the thing that was propelling me more than anything else. It was more like running away, even though that sounds like I'm saying something else, because it's the kind of thing that, like, I live in the UK, this is my life, that's where my family live, that's not where I'm from.
Mm-hmm. What you're describing sounds like you're just living the music video for the Bronski Beat song, the Runaway song.
I don't know that.
Oh, it's this great song from the 80s that is basically, it's this kid, and I want to say he's Irish, I can't remember now, but, you know, exactly what you're describing, like, he's got this, like, home life that is going nowhere, and he just gets on a train and heads to the city and encounters, he's got male friends who he eventually finds his place, like, in the process of getting there, and this is, like, it's a music video, so it's, like, 2.5 minutes, But it's that migration that you're describing of like I just got to get to the place and I'll figure it out once I'm there.
Yeah.
What kind of work did you wind up finding?
Well, I ended up being like unemployed for about a year, and I was just like, and I knew no one in the country, and I got kind of depressed, and it got really rough at times with like how little money I had. But I was also kind of like, you know, asking my dad to help me out when he could, but it wasn't particularly good. But I sort of thought, well, I'm not getting a job, nothing's really happening, and I was applying for everything I could. I decided, you know what, I'll go do a master's. So I decided to do a master's in illustration because I sort of thought, oh, I'll take the skills I have and kind of rehabilitate myself a bit, because if I want to do this whole illustration thing, I suppose I should either get qualified, even though qualification's kind of pointless for it, but just expose myself to it and see what'll happen. So I kind of just plucked up the gumption to apply to Camberwell College of Arts, which is in South London. It's a lovely college. I had one of the best times of my life there. Its famous alumni include Florence Welch and the singer Des Ree.
Oh, okay, sure.
it's a small college, it was the only one that was like offering illustration courses, and yeah, it was terrific.
So you'd had such a rough time your first go around with your undergrad degree. Why did you decide to go back to school?
I kind of just assumed it was the thing that you do, like you get a master's, because that's when like your creative practice really comes to life. I think it's because I felt that what the problems I had in my undergraduate weren't to do with education. It was just specifically with how I was working and how I was to some extent being graded and things like that. Not to sound like, you know, I'm trying to grind an axe and say like they never appreciated me or something like that. That wasn't it. I think there was a lot of things happening that weren't conducive to my success.
Sure.
Yeah.
So this is sort of like a second chance for both you and academia.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
So how did it go?
It went really, really well. One thing which kind of I struggled with when I was like studying animation was just there. While it is an art form, one thing that is very valued in it as an art form and an industry is homogeneity. Like if you can replicate someone's style, if you can replicate whatever, and that can be fine, but it just didn't work for me. I remember one thing that sort of I really used to get quite depressed about was, because I was mostly looking at like film history with like this long breath of like, you know, oh, let's watch this film, let's watch Rebecca. Like I'd always want to watch something that like has supposed merit but isn't like, say, first and foremost in everyone's minds. And what I always found a bit daunting was when we were being taught animation history, it was taught from like a very Disney-centric view. So which I understand that they're a dominating cultural force, for better or worse, because you can say the bad things they've done as a result of that, like the union smashing and all that. But what I always found it particularly daunting was we would be told to look at these Disney movies, often from the 40s and 50s, and look at them as if they were still relevant today.
Okay, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a historical context, but there's also, like, you know, time marches on.
Yeah, exactly. And like, we would be told to look at them as if they were absolutely, without question, perfect. Like, the filmmaking is perfect, and oftentimes, while they are enjoyable, they are not, quote, good films. You know, the editing is a bit sloppy, the pacing is bizarre, the characterization is weak. Sure. They have charm, but, and they look pretty.
Not to mention, there's often, like, you know, I've mentioned earlier, I just watched John Carter of Mars, and it felt like a very old-fashioned Disney film to me, in part because of the racist and colonialist attitudes of the film.
Oh boy, yeah. And even just, like, things like, so you know the Rescuers, right?
Sure, yeah.
Well, Disney had nine old men. That was like the original animators of Disney. They were called the Nine Old Men. One of them was the lead animator on The Rescuers, and he based the character of Madame Medusa, voiced by the iconic Geraldine Page. He based her on his ex-wife, which I'm like, oh buddy.
No.
It's like, it's one, because I think it's one thing if you're an actor doing it, but when you're sitting there drawing day after day this character of your ex-wife, I don't know. That's weird. But the thing which I always thought was daunting to me was, like, we'd be told to watch these films as if they were still relevant in the noughties, and I'd be like, I'm a white English speaking guy, like, I'm not that different from the guys that made these films, but, like, God forbid I'm any of the women in my course, because what do they have to, like, look to in these films necessarily? Like, are you saying that nothing has happened in the three generations of filmmakers that have come in between us and them, like, nothing to expand upon? And because I had this breadth of, like, Hollywood film at the time, like, I just sort of thought, oh, I'll look at this thing. And, like, I remember then we went to a film festival at one point in France called Annecy, which is, like, the Cannes of animation. And there was a book in, like, the bookshop there, and it, I hate saying this, it blew my mind. It was basically a book of, like, Disney films shown in context alongside Hollywood films that were being made at the same time, which even I, like, had never really thought of putting those two things together, because they're being made in the same city.
Sure.
Yeah, at the same time, so of course. And, like, I knew a few things, like the fact that the Evil Queen is based off Joan Crawford, who Disney had a huge crush on. But it's also not surprising, because she's one of the biggest movie stars in the world, you know? Like, that happens today. I'm trying to think of an example. Oh, the Sophia Boutella character from Star Trek Beyond is based on Jennifer Lawrence, for instance.
Okay.
Like, okay, and sure. And going into it knowing that, you see some of the mannerisms. Like, you know, that happens all the time. But I remember then, like, seeing this book, and, like, there'd be stills of, like, things from Disney films, which I knew, and stills from, like, live-action films, which I knew. So, like, for instance, they would have the evil stepmother from Cinderella next to Mrs. Danvers from Rebecca, which I had watched, like, five times. And it's like,
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And now that you see it, like, of course.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And that just was like, oh my God, yes, I was right, like, in how I was sort of, like, just trying to have as broad an understanding as possible, not just, like, look at, say, this one particular set of films, which, I don't know why that was relevant. I think it was because it was meant to be about Camberwell, wasn't it?
Well, I mean, it sounds like this book really changed something for you. Like, either it changed your approach, or it sounds like it might have changed your ambition with the work that you were doing.
Yeah, it was also useful for, like, vindication, just sort of to feel that, like, it's kind of goes back to everything I was saying, like, about how I was so in love with, like, even just films growing up as a teen, just, like, this feeling of, oh, there is, like, this bigger world, like when you hear about films that, you know, you liked when you were a weird little teen, that, oh, you're saying like queer people love Mildred Pierce and Baby Jane? Like, I was just watching them. I had no idea that like, you know, Alaska Thunderfuck is going to do a perfect recreation of Bette Davis on All Stars 2, right?
Mm-hmm.
For instance, or anything like that. Like, I had no clue. And it's nice to feel that, like, oh, no, there is, like, this, I mean, community out there, but just, like, other people see it. It's not just you. Other people know how fabulous, like, Sunset Boulevard is across mm-hmm. the board. You're not just being a weird person that likes some crappy old black and white movie. It's like, no, it's really good.
Did you find that, like, that acknowledgement, just basically that you're being seen, like, your interests are valid and other people have the same thing, like, did that give you sort of a, like, a renewed motivation or renewed focus?
Oh, completely. And even just like, you know how it is, there's I feel like this is something like how from where I grew up, where there's this thing where I understand that when you make a reference to something and someone doesn't know it, the other person can easily feel stupid, and no one wants to feel stupid. But there's a way to, like, still tell the story and make this reference, even if the person doesn't get it. And, like, you know, they can still, like, oh, cool, okay, I kind of get it. And the thing I struggled a bit with, and I don't know if this is me or if it's, say, the way people speak where I grew up, it's a bit like, if they don't immediately understand the reference, then they kind of, like, shut off and they don't even want to try and let you give them some cliff notes, you know? So I remember a lot of the time I would feel like I'd make a reference to something and I'd be like, cool, that didn't land, even if it isn't that deep a cut, you know? And it's that thing where when you have that being layered and layered on top of it, you do start to feel like, oh, I might as well just not speak. But then, yeah, it was nice having some sort of validations, like, okay, cool. Like, and you know, even on Twitter to this day, like, I do play up the fact that I'll go on and on about, like, dead art directors from the 1940s that no one cares about, but I care. And I like to think that, you know, someone can at least join me on the journey of madness.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about that journey then. Tell me about the work that you started doing after grad school and the work that you're doing today.
Well, actually, I probably should say the stuff I did at grad school because that ends up being really important and it's a good continuation of it. Cool. So I was doing an illustration course at Camberwell, which I wasn't terribly, like, experimental earlier in my life. And for some reason, I sort of thought, cool, I'm going to do experimental work now. I'm going to be, like, really experimental, but not like bad experimental, like good experimental. Do you remember, you've seen Ghost World, have you?
Yes, although it has been a while.
Do you remember the terrible art film that the teacher shows them at the start?
Yes. Yeah, vaguely. I don't remember the details, but I remember that that's a thing.
It's called, like, Mirror, Father, Mirror, and it's just like this voice going, Mirror, Father, Mirror, and there's, like, lots of shots of, like, silhouettes of feet walking upstairs and, like, a dismembered doll being put in the toilet and, like, shots of crucifixes. Like, it's very much that type of art film. And in my head,
mm-hmm.
To me, which isn't really fair, I was like, again, I want to do good experimental, not that kind of, you know, it's just, is this experimental or is it just bad? So I decided that I was going to do a project about Anton Walbrook. Do you know who that is?
No.
Cool. He is, I realize that probably sounds a bit dismissive. It's just, I'm on the autistic spectrum, so I tend to just run off scripts in my head. So a lot of phrases I have like that tend to just sort of sound like they're...
Sure.
Blunt, but it's just sort of like I've just learned this trick as a way to segue into the next part of what I was saying. But yeah, he was this gay Austrian British actor who is in The Red Shoes, that film I mentioned earlier, the ballet film. When Black Swan came out, they talked so much about The Red Shoes. It's usually academically called the greatest British film ever made, which is a pretty fair assessment, I think. It's great in the way Gone with the Wind is great, you know, like as in sweeping themes about about art and madness and giving yourself for your art and choices, and it's got beautiful production values, and it's all about fairy tales and myths, so it's, but it's actually so good. But like, I always just, for some reason, I just latched on to him because I thought he's really weird and interesting. He's got this strange screen persona that's like really intense but really ethereal. So I thought that I'd do a series of mixed media illustrations where I would recreate some of his films, but I would draw him, cut him out, and then stage it, photograph it, after doing like all lighting and everything on it, and then that would be like my graduate project, which ended up going down really well. But it was a way to like, okay, I'm gonna go deep and look at like his 1930s films, which no one has heard about, and they're all just like weird German films or not very good English films that like no one's really watched since the 30s. But like, it was nice getting to be that indulgent and just to be like, I'm going to make something that's unapologetically just like about this really specific, weird, unnecessarily detailed thing I like.
How did that go over?
It actually went over really well because I got quite a good grade on my graduation because of it, which I was not expecting.
Like, that sounds like it gives you a promising direction.
Yeah. It did. Like, when I graduated, I had like newfound confidence just in everything, myself as a person, my own work. Kind of soon after, I ended up doing videography work and like motion graphics, which was, it was not an easy job to do emotionally, but I learned a lot of useful techniques out of it and skills, and like that kind of sort of just like kept, kind of like everyone's experience, just whenever you start being an adult, like it kind of just accumulated and I start getting more work. And I've always like jumped around a lot, doing like I'll do a little bit of illustration work, a bit of design work, a bit of animation work, so I'm never quite sure what it is that like I say I do. And like, one of the things I do for fun as well is just, you know, endless Oscar trivia stats and things like that, which started just as a way to kind of teach myself graphic design.
So what keeps you busy now? Like, what is the work that you're doing, and what's the stuff that you're like proud of having produced?
Well, my job at the moment is doing kind of like location design for a TV show, and I can't really talk about it any further than that.
Okay.
But it's really good. It's just getting to do like drawing all day and like location design and details. It's a wonderful job, and I'm really thankful for it. And the kind of side stuff I do mostly at the moment is trying to finish up the updates on my Oscar stats, because, you know, they were in February and it's now early May, so I've taken 3 months to do far too little work almost. But that'll be exciting. Every year always brings like its own sets of firsts and records and things like that. But that's kind of like, I have sort of mixed feelings about it, because I'm proud that it exists, but sometimes you get that feeling of, damn, I have spent far too long working on this. But I suppose like one of the pieces of work I'm most proud of is a short film I made, which was originally my graduate project for my BA that took 6 years to make, I think. Yeah, 6 years. It's an animated short all about follies and like kind of misshapen aristocrats who build them. Do I have to explain what a folly is?
You know, that might not be familiar. So like, the first thing I thought you were talking about was the Sondheim musical. So
no.
yeah,
the problem is like to explain it, it's like, oh crap, this is gonna be like a really English reference. So generally like in England, there's lots of stately homes that like you can go visit for the day. They're kind of owned by like the National Trust, so like they're kind of they're it's like going to, you know, the list of historic places type thing, like Belvedere Castle in New York, that kind of thing. And often what they have on the grounds is they'll have like these small little buildings, which are generally just like a room. And that's a folly. Generally, the idea is that, like, you're so rich that you own so much land that you're like, ooh, I want to decorate the vista from my stately home, so I'll just have, like, a little classical temple just on the top of that hill over there. And the stories of people that build them, like, are often Some of it is like disgusting aristocrats. Some of it is like two spinster sisters go on a trip to Italy, and when they get back to Dorset, they want a little piece of the classical world in their garden. And I was just wanting to try and make a bunch of stories back to back all about like those types of people.
So how is that? So this is a project that you've been working on for a while. Like, what state is it in? And like, is it?
Oh, it's finished. I finished it a while ago. I should have mentioned it comes after I finished at Camberwell while I was working in videography, and like I would work all day there, and then I'd go home at night and just work on animating this film, and like as a way to like try and train myself up properly in using After Effects and like how to animate properly. And it's kind of like a recurring thing with me. Like, I seem to always be working on something at all times just to tick over and keep busy and to keep, like, expanding on skills.
So looking back at, like, that kid in a small town and the person that you were when you were struggling through college the first time, like, what advice or, like, what message would you have for that younger version of you?
Oh, boy. I think often I think if I was being really, really curt, because that's what I would do, I'd just be like, don't worry, you're right. Like, that's the thing which oftentimes so much of my life after that period has been like, no, everything I was feeling was right. I was being given either terrible advice or not being encouraged the right way. And it's basically to try and instill some sort of confidence in myself. That would be like the most useful thing I could do.
Mm. Well, what gave you the confidence?
I actually don't know. I think it's just you get to a point where suddenly the things which people used to make fun of you for, you know, like your dated cultural references, for instance, suddenly those things are really useful whenever someone needs to fill you in on what's being referenced in an episode of Drag Race, for instance.
Yeah, feeling like you are part of the group and you get it now. You understand what people are talking about.
Yeah.
So if people want to check out your work and see what you've made online, where can they go?
Yeah, well, I'm most active on Twitter, and you can find me at Dashiell Silva, and that's also my Instagram handle. But Twitter is the best place to find me.
Perfect. Well, thanks again so much for joining me.
No problem.
Thanks for listening, and thanks to Dashiell for joining me. For my recommendations this week, I have to apologize a bit, because I suspect that this is not a work that Dashiell would be enthusiastic about. But his mention of the Celtic Tiger period in Ireland's history and the timing makes it too good an opportunity to pass up. This weekend, from July 3rd through July 5th, 2020, Andrew Lloyd Webber's YouTube channel will be broadcasting an absolutely bonkers dance special called Michael Flatley Celtic Tiger. Flatley, if you're not familiar, is the ostentatious dancer who created a weird mid-90s fad of Irish step dancing, driving audiences, primarily PBS moms, into a frenzy for fiddles and tap shoes. When Flatley toured through Connecticut many years ago, I went to see him with my parents, and I remember virtually nothing about it because his shows are like a drug-addled vision. He'll blast you with lights, fast music, a billion costume changes, and a frantic, stompy style that obliterates your ability to process any information whatsoever, and I love how weird it is. His Celtic Tiger show comes as close to achieving high camp as heterosexual glands will allow. Without dialogue, it tells the story of Ireland's history back to snake times, which should give you a sense of just how historically accurate it is, through the struggle against British occupation, and then, for some reason, it becomes a tribute to America. Nothing can prepare you for the sharp left turn into American patriotism, leading up to a finale that heavily features Yankee Doodle. The show was filmed around 2005, and it'll be available to watch starting this Friday and ending on Sunday. That a musical about defeating the British is also a fundraiser for Britain's NHS is not even remotely the weirdest thing about it. Thanks again for listening, and thanks to everyone who makes The Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Patreon backers get rewards like stickers in the mail, a copy of my book Defining Marriage, and also exclusive access to the Patreon-only podcast Cozy Pants, in which I chat with my partner James about the entertainment that's bringing us joy right now. Head over to patreon.com/MattBaum to support the show and get access to those benefits. I post clips of the stuff that we talk about on each episode on Twitter and Facebook. You can reach out and let me know your thoughts on the show at sewerspodcast@gmail.com. And join us for the next live stream on July 4th at 11 a.m. Pacific. Check out my YouTube channel for the latest Culture Cruise video. That's a deep dive into the LGBTQ milestones from TV and film that have changed the world. This month's Culture Cruise is all about the documentary Paris is Burning, its hidden history, and also how Madonna lifted more than just voguing for her career. The theme song for The Sewers of Paris is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin MacLeod of Comptech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.